Welcome. This week's show with Yvette Stanton is brought to you by Sassy Jack Stitchery and the Embroiderers Guild of America. The Embroiderers Guild of America at egausa.org is an organization of needle artists dedicated to inspiring passion for the needle arts through education and the celebration of its heritage. Members range from beginners to experts working within local chapters or at-large networks to take their skills to the next level. Couple of things you need to note that the EGA is offering, and it makes it worth the membership by far, is the virtual lecture series, which is the second Saturday of each month at 1 o'clock Eastern Time, 1 p.m. Eastern Time. Last month was Tony Gertis on Japanese internment camp art. Very, very impressive presentation, well worth the time. The March presentation from Jackie Clarkson is on sashiko, a form of Japanese embroidery. And then in April, the culture of folk art embroidery in three European countries will be presented by Sarah Pedlow. And that's available to members. That's free of charge, available to members at 1 o'clock on the second Saturday of each month. Really an excellent benefit for being an EGA member. Also, you want to check out online courses, a new one. The registration is just open. Winter Lights with Jennifer Reifenberg. And that registration is open through April 7. Then you'll also want to, this one's very interesting, a group correspondence course. It's a lightning round that's available through June 1. The title is Embroidery with Mixed Media, and Laura Smith is the instructor. And you'll learn to work with soluble fabric, DuPont Tyvek, Angelina fibers, and film and acrylic gel media. And these materials are used to make expressive qualities that extend the possibilities of embroidered designs. That looks like a lot of fun and just a chance to play with some different materials. And, of course, then you'll want to be sure and sign up for the Magnificent Stitch 2021 National Seminar hosted by the Great Lakes Region. It will be held in Chicago September 1 through 5, and registration opens March 13. And you can learn all about that and how to become a member at EGA. You can either join through a local chapter or be a member at large. That's what I am, and that's working out very well for me. And that's at egausa.org. And then, of course, our second sponsor for this show is Sassy Jack Stitchery. And Kim Young at Sassy Jack's is currently working with us to provide the new Cosmo Thread Club and kits for Mary Jane Fry sampler that Amanda Rowe has provided for us. And now here's a word from Kim.
Sassy Jack Stitchery is happy to be a sponsor of Fiber Talk. We so appreciate all the heart that Gary and team put into their show, and we always look forward to each episode. Thank you, Fiber Talk, for all you do for our needlework world. Sassy Jack's is a vibrant needlework shop located in the mountains of western North Carolina, just north of Asheville. We're in the process of moving our shop to its forever home in a historic folk Victorian on the National Listing of Historic Places, just 3 miles down the road from our current location. While we're moving, you can find us in all our normal online haunts, our website at sassyjackstitchery.com, Facebook, Instagram, and YouTube. We can't wait to open our doors and welcome you into our new old home. It was always the plan to be in this beautiful old house, and we've invested a huge chunk of our hearts into its renovation. Every renovated board, every push-button light switch, every old porch swing has lovingly, mostly, been placed there with our own hands. It has a wonderful, warm, welcoming feel about the place already, and your stitchy joy and laughter with friends will really make it home for Sassy Jack's. So look for us online for the next few months, as we'll be filling online and phone orders as per usual, and we'll be looking forward to the spring at the Baird House in Asheville, North Carolina. When the time comes, we'll leave the light on for you, just like your mom did when you were a kid, so you'll know it's time to come home. Now on to the show.
Welcome back. I'm Gary Parr.
And I'm Beth Ellicott.
And you're listening to Fiber Talk, the twice weekly podcast for needlework artists. Our artist this week from the Australia, Yvette Stanton. Yvette, welcome.
Hello. Thank you.
Yes, this, believe it or not, this is guest show number 200. Holy smokes.
Amazing.
Wow. Yeah, you were number 14. The first time we talked, you were number 14. And now number 200.
Well, there you are.
And I didn't realize it until I looked it up that it had been that long. Wow.
Yeah. I didn't realize it had been that long either, actually.
Yeah. Because we've talked about you many, many times in the interim.
But, oh, thanks.
But not with you. Yeah. Yeah.
I've talked about you in the interim as well.
Oh, okay. Well, we appreciate that. Yeah. So, yeah, I just couldn't believe it. Yeah. And so we got to do this more often. We can't be letting all of the 2017 to 2021, that's too long. So we'll make a date to do it sooner the next time. Yep.
That sounds good to me.
Yeah. So, and I was, before we started recording, I was saying that the last couple of days I've been listening to your videos. And to everybody out there, let's go, folks. She needs more subscribers. You know, come on.
Absolutely. I was surprised. You know, I was like, there's only 300 people that's watching. This is crazy. There's got to be thousands of people watching this. She's excellent.
Yes.
Well, thank you. But I am relatively unknown, I think. So,
well, you need to be more known. So, folks, okay. Yvette Stanton, Vetti Creations, look it up on YouTube and subscribe.
Lovely.
Yes. And push the button so you get all the notifications, because she's been doing a lot of them. You're up like 70 of them, right?
I did number 68 yesterday.
Yeah. So subscribe, folks. You'll learn things. Even if you never do a lick of white work, trust me, you'll learn something. I guarantee it. Yeah. They're very good. Yes. Really well done.
Full of great information.
Yep. And plus you get to... Go ahead.
I just tend to find that I'm educating while I'm talking. I can't help it. I tell people stuff.
Yep. No, you do. And, you know, and on top of that, you get to listen to that beautiful Australian accent. And so, you know, that we'll take that all day long. So.
Well, I'm glad you like it.
It's one of my favorites. One of my favorites. So, so let's go, folks. Subscribe. Get those numbers up. Okay. When we talked back in 2017, early style hardanger. All right. No, first. All right. Say it. Hardanger. Is that right?
Well, I say hardanger, but I'm Australian. The proper way to say it would be hardanger.
There. See, I knew that.
I always forget. I can't ever remember which way you're supposed to pronounce that one.
All right.
Hardanger.
Hardanger. See, I got corrected that it's hardanger. And I think it's hardanger. And okay, I'm sticking with what I know. All right. Hardanger. I'm going with that. So whoever told me that it was wrong, that I was wrong, no. So that book was just out. And first book of yours that I bought. And it's a terrific book. It's a terrific book. But I enjoyed, you know, and that's the thing that you do. How many books do you have? You have
my 10th one is at the printer at the moment.
Yes. Yeah. And I just love the way you go back to the origins and capture. What's that?
I think it's important.
Yeah. I mean, to me, that's the thing, is you preserve and capture the origins of these techniques. And because, see, when I learned hardanger, it was on that 22-count hardanger cloth.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, which just made your hair stand up, I know, but
can you see me as well as hear me? Wow.
But so it was that book that set me straight on how this technique is done. And so for me, that book has importance beyond just the techniques. And do you find that book, did it change thinking?
Look, I don't really know. I don't get a huge amount of feedback from people on that sort of thing. I would hope that it has helped to educate people on the way that hardanger was originally done, and that it's not as big and chunky as you get with 22 count fabric. It's still, yes, it absolutely gets my goat when people say that 22 count hardanger fabric is the fabric you should use for hardanger. They never did. They used fine, fine, fine linens. And they were like 60 count. Generally, when they're doing their hardanger these days for their boonads, they use about 35 count, 36 count. But originally, hardanger was much, much finer than even that. So 22 count is nothing like it.
Well, and for a learning tool, you can see why people suggest it. But the word chunky compared to what you do on higher count linens, the word chunky is exactly that. Yeah, it really does. Yeah. Yeah.
They're very, very different. The scale, the changing of the scale from big to small, just it changes the whole look of the embroidery.
Yeah.
Yes, it's gorgeous. And I remember holding that book and looking through it the first time and just being amazed because, like Gary, I learned on 22 count. That's mm-hmm. how I learned. And that's what I taught people how to, when I taught them how to do hardanger, how yep. to stitch, you know, because that's all, I didn't know any better. But
yeah, and that's where I started higher... too. My first one was on 22 count, and I did that when I was at school, and that's what I was presented with as being the correct fabric to use.
Yeah. So what? Tell about that experience when you go to talk to people who do it the right way. I assume you were aware that that was not the proper ground cloth before you went to do your research, but...
Yes, I did.
Yeah.
So often when I do my research, I don't even get to speak to the people who do the embroidery anymore because sometimes they don't exist anymore. So a lot of my research is done in museums, looking at very, very old pieces and observing how they did things. I always take many, many photographs of the front and the back so that if I have to reconstruct a stitch with the back, with the information that's there, I can usually do it. So sometimes that might mean sitting down for some days and trying and trying and trying until I manage to recreate the stitch the way that I see it on an old piece, because I'm not working with any instructions. All I'm doing is trying to make my front and my back match what that was.
Okay. Did you have help? Were you able to talk to people who actually do hardanger the right way for that one, or was that all museum work?
For that one, I had some very old hardanger, some very old Norwegian books on hardanger, and they were helpful. They were, of course, in Norwegian, and I don't speak or read Norwegian, though I'm getting better at it. I know quite a few textile-related words in Norwegian now. So I don't think I spoke to... No, I did speak to someone who does it still. So the curator at the Hardanger Folk Museum in Utna, she sees her responsibility as not only preserving the old items of embroidery, but also to preserve the techniques of how to do it. So she runs classes there so that people can preserve the skills as well as the actual things.
Mm-hmm. So you had somebody, but still, it's the books, yeah.
Yeah, I don't think I really asked her all that many technical questions about how to do it. More, it was about the things that they would use, so the threads and the fabric and that sort of thing.
Yeah. Because that's the, you know, obviously all your books are great in and of themselves, but for me, the thread that ties them all together is that you're preserving these old techniques and making sure that we have the origins and that they don't go away. Because, I mean, that's, as time goes on, become more of a concern of mine, is that these older techniques are getting lost. And
yes.
Very few people who are making sure they're still alive.
Yeah. Well, I actually see myself, like I've always seen myself as an embroiderer, but more and more I'm seeing myself as an embroidery historian, mm-hmm. as someone who seeks out the history of these things and records it. So when I did my Smoig book, that was the first book that had ever been written in any language on how to do the technique. And I'm incredibly proud of the fact that I was able to do that. I just think it's really, really important that we're able to preserve these things and not just the actual historical pieces, but how to do it.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, because, yeah, I mean, museums probably will always have the old pieces, but, you know, how to do it. And to give people a means to learn how and spread, and these days be able to spread that all around the world is just so important.
Yeah, Sometimes we're limited with what threads and fabric we have available to us. So there are some very old embroideries that are beautifully fine that we just don't have access to fabrics and threads that are that fine anymore. And that's a bit of a problem. So things like Dresden embroidery was worked on very, very fine fabrics, which we're not able to get anymore. And the threads would have been fine as well, and we can't get them. So there are some styles of embroidery that are going to be lost to us on that scale. And as we've discussed already, the difference of scale does make a difference to the embroidery. So we could do Dresden embroidery on, say, 25 count fabric with a suitable thickness thread, but it wouldn't be the same as if we used very, very fine linen cambric sorts of fabrics.
Yeah, I've had discussions in recent weeks more than once about this issue of, can you get good ground cloth linen anymore? Can you get the threads you need? And, those people are getting old and retiring and their kids don't want to do it. And the machinery gets old and it just goes away. And for most of it, it's just lost forever. It's a real shame.
It is, yeah.
Yeah. Are you finding it harder to get the kinds of materials you need, or do you have to keep adapting?
I am finding it more and more difficult. So even back right near the beginning of my career, when I wrote my book on Mareshka, which is Ukrainian drawn threadwork, the thread that I was using for that was a number 12 cotton abroda. At the time that I was writing the book, that was discontinued. So even way back then, and that's probably 15 years ago, that happened then. But I'm finding that the other linens that I have been using, some of them are starting to be discontinued, which is really quite disappointing. But I don't know that there's anything that we can do about it unless, enough of us continue to purchase them and use them. That's the only way that we'll keep them on the market.
Yeah.
There has to be a demand for there to be a supply.
Right. Right. Because you're using linen threads, and which is, can you talk a little bit about the use of those? Because that's so, I'm used to using pearl cotton when we do artinger, but
yep.
You kind of talked a little bit about linen is better.
Yeah, so traditionally for Hardanger, they used linen thread on linen fabric, and it's got some real advantages to it. So if you think about when you're wearing your linen shirt, it gets creased very, very easily. Well, the same happens with linen thread. So if you're doing pulled thread work and you want it to crease in a particular way, if you just pinch it, it will crease and it will stay. Whereas other threads, they lose a little bit of their tension. It's more likely to keep it because it has that natural ability to crease, and we can make use of that. So I find that it's really helpful for doing things like drawn thread work and pulled thread work, because we can take advantage of that characteristic of it. It also, some of the pieces that I saw in the Hardanger Folk Museum in Utna, it was on linen with linen thread, but the linen thread was so shiny, it looked like it was a very, very shiny thread. What's the
like
one that they
silk?
Use for Brazilian? No, shinier than that. Oh, rayon thread.
Rayon.
It looked that shiny.
Oh.
And that was just because it had been ironed and basically burnished so many times that it was beautifully shiny. So there are some different aspects to linen thread than people are used to seeing. Often when I first started talking about linen thread, people used to think of that horrible stuff that DMC brought out many years ago, which was just like using straw. But the sort of linen thread that I'm talking about is not like that at all. It's a beautifully fine twisted thread, which is lovely to use, unlike them.
Yeah, I had some of that thread, and I was like, this feels like using sandpaper. I can't stitch with this stuff.
Yes, it was horrible stuff, and it's not surprising that it's no longer available. I think the market told them something about that product.
Yeah.
Is good linen thread still readily available, or is that...
It is actually, yes. Yeah. So the thread that I generally tend to use is Londonderry linen thread. It's available in the European market as Gold's Child linen thread, but there's other threads in Sweden and Norway that I know of, and there are probably others as well that I'm unfamiliar with. So in Europe particularly, yes, linen threads are readily available still.
But not now in Australia, you have to import everything, right?
Of course.
Yeah, okay. Okay, figured that. Yeah.
Yeah.
What are you going to do? Yep. Yeah. Well, that's okay. So that's something, because I just in getting ready for this, I had your book out and was going through it. And I, oh, man, I had a couple projects I wanted to do, but I never started them. And I really should get some. Beth, we need to get linen thread. All right.
Okay.
All right. We'll yeah. order some.
Get on to it.
Yeah, and do it the right way.
No, it's a really different experience stitching with cotton as compared to linen. And so if you haven't tried it before, I certainly advise you to give it a go. Why not try something new?
Yes, and I when I was listening to you and you said you could crease it, because that's my problem. When I'm doing any sort of wrapped bar, you know, you think you've got it nice and tight and you're in there and you just release a little bit of tension and it just like... And it's like, that's not as tight as I want it to be.
Well, you so might find that this helps.
Oh, perfect. I love threads. So permission to get more. That's just what I need.
I give you permission.
All right,
Thank
Beth.
Thank you, Yvette.
All right. We know some people. We're going to have to do some ordering, Beth. That's just all there is.
Uh-huh.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
The things we have to do for Fiber
yeah.
Talk.
Yeah, it's tough. It really is tough, you know, that we got to try
is.
This stuff.
It
you
is.
Know?
Absolutely.
Yeah. You know, miserable existence. So, all right, that's our next mission then is a proper. Now, when we order the linen thread, then what ground cloth are we going to order?
So if you're going to do some of the projects out of my Hardanger book, you'll be wanting 36 count linen. So that okay. would be an Edinburgh linen, if you're using Zweigart. And with that, you would use two different thicknesses of thread. You would use the 50 over 3 Londonderry linen and the 80 over 3 Londonderry linen. So the 50 over 3 is thicker, and that's the one you would use for your satin stitching, and the 80 over 3 is the one that you would use for practically everything else.
Okay. And name the linen, the ground cloth again?
If you're using Zweigart, then it would be an Edinburgh linen, which is a 36 count.
All right. I'm making a shopping list, see?
Yeah, right I can here. Tell.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. All right.
I got my own right here.
I can send
here.
You one if you it. Like.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, we could just order from you. Yeah.
Well, no, I mean, I can send you a shopping list.
Oh, okay.
And
oh, okay.
with that, you want to use 26, number 26 tapestry needles.
Okay. I got those. That's not a problem.
Excellent.
Yeah. All right. New project on the horizon. Yep.
Because we don't have enough.
No.
No. No. Now, I remember when your Smoig work came out, and I was very interested in that because I had just done a Ukrainian, and I can't pronounce it. It starts with an N. And it was a darning.
Yeah.
And it looked so similar.
I don't know the correct way to pronounce that, but something like Nazinka.
Yes. So how are those similar and how are those different?
Look, I'm not really familiar with Nazinka. Okay. I apologize to everyone if I am saying that wrong. It's similar. I'm not going to answer that. I'm sorry. I don't want to say something that's incorrect. They
okay.
are similar,
right.
but they are different.
All right. So is it just because they just... The colors are very similar. It was just intriguing when I saw your book come out.
So it's a very similar technique in that you use running stitch and it's counted running stitch. They would use similar colors, but they would have different motifs grown up out of different cultures. And they would have possibly slightly different ways of doing some of the stitches.
Go ahead.
So when they did the colors on the smoig, because when we did the Ukrainian one, it was, we wove the colors on top.
So some of the smoig is done that way, and I will stop and say I'm saying smoig, and that's just because I'm Australian. The correct way to say it, so it's SMO with a slash through it, YG. So the O with a slash through it is an sound, and then you've got the E from the Y as well. So it's smoig. Right? Got that?
Yep.
Yes.
When I watched one of your videos and you were doing that, you were explaining how to pronounce it. I was trying right along with you, and I just
I'm
gave
sure
up.
you were. Okay, so we can continue to say smoig if we want to.
Okay.
So some types of smoig, and it's done in many different regions, mostly in the south of Norway, and each different little place has their own way of using it. So they have different ways of using colour, and they have different ways of using the threads and that sort of thing. So some of them they will use wool threads, some of them will use more silk, but sometimes they will just use one colour as the base. So often you'll have two basic layers of stitching, and some of them just have the base layer, and that is just all stitched back and forth in running stitch in one colour. But then once they've come to the end of that section, they might change colours, and so you can have stripes of different colours, and that's quite a common thing. So you might have a section that's red with a blue section, then a green section, and then red, or you might have red, green, red, blue, and alternating like that. But then there are other styles that have, say, a base color, which might be black, and then into the gaps where they've left space for the fabric to show through, then they might come back and work other colors into those spaces. So there's basically two different ways of doing it. Sometimes you just have the one color, which may change because of stripes, and other times you might have more than one color. A base layer and then other colors worked on top. So that sounds more like the Nazinka style, possibly, that you did.
Yeah, okay.
How much of a shock to your system was it to be working in all those bright colors when you do so much white work?
Well, I love color. People think, like when I did my stitch dictionaries, I think I shocked so many people because they're fully color with lots of colored stitching. And I think people went, "Oh my goodness, Yvette can do color." Well, yes, of course Yvette can do color. Yvette loves color, but she also loves white on white. So it wasn't that much of a shock to me. It was probably just more of a shock to everyone else.
Because when you look at the pictures of your books all lined up, it's that one right there with all the color, and it's
Right.
Yeah.
Right.
but that it's amazing, like the one video where you wore the shirt that you did with the collar. I mean, it's such striking. The patterns are so striking and the colors are so rich, and I mean, I can see why you did a book on it, because it really is, it looks fun to stitch those.
And it was from when I was in Norway to research for the Hardanger book. I timed it to be there at the same time as Norwegian Constitution Day, which is the 17th of May, and that's a really, really big day in the Norwegian calendar. And they come out and they parade through their towns in their beautiful bunads, which is their folk costume, and they usually have different styles for different regions and towns. And so across Norway, there's so many different styles, and I happened to be in Bergen that day, and got to see so many beautiful clothes, and one of the ones that really caught my eye was from Telemark, and so that started a whole new journey into smoig because I just had to know about it.
Now, help me with what is Telemark? Is that a region?
Yes, it's a region in
Okay.
Norway. So there's East Telemark and there's Vest Telemark, which is West Telemark, and they're just basically like, I guess, provinces, regions, that sort of thing.
Okay.
So Hardanger is another, well, Hardanger, no, Hardanger is not a region. Hordaland is the region that Hardanger is, and it's a bit north of them.
It fascinates me that such a relatively small part of the world has such diversity.
Yeah, and I've thought a bit about that, and I think it's because so much of the country probably was untraversable during the winter. So roads would have been cut, or if they didn't have roads at that stage because it was too early for that, then paths and things would have been cut. And so people probably were quite insular, and getting around wasn't so easy to do. So I think that's probably how things grew up in such small areas, that you can have something so different just a few, you know, miles, kilometers apart.
Yeah.
It's... in Norway, are they still making their own costumes?
They do, yes. So they wear their bunads for special occasions like weddings and christenings. I know that for things like the opening of Parliament, then a lot of the women parliamentarians will wear their bunads for that. I went on a needlework cruise some years ago, and we had a Norwegian couple that came along as part of that. And so when we dressed up for dinner, they wore their beautiful bunads. So they're worn for special occasions and that sort of thing. So, yes, they still do wear them. Usually a girl would get her bunad for her confirmation, which is usually around 15 years of age. And it probably in times past might have been sewn by her grandmother. These days, not so many grandmothers necessarily have those skills, so they can commission someone else to do it for them. But that doesn't mean one person doing it. There's usually someone who specializes in doing the shirts. There might be someone who specializes in making the aprons. There might be someone else who specializes in making the embroidered waistcoats. So all different parts come together, and you usually have to commission these people several years in advance because there is such a demand for their skills.
That's amazing. But it's neat that they're keeping that tradition up.
Oh, it's lovely, yeah. And for some people who are stitchers, they are able to make their own, which is fabulous.
That's so neat. Yeah, so neat. Did I detect, in watching all these videos, did I detect a little bit more excitement when you were talking about Mount Melek? It just seemed to me like you there was a little more... a little faster heartbeat or something. I mean, that stuff is fascinating to me, and it's such a heavier design that, I don't know, maybe it was just me reading into it, but you just seem to get a little hair more excited about it. I don't know.
Well, that's interesting. I do love stitching Mount Melek because I love playing with stitches, and that's something that I really get to do with that. So some of the Mount Melek designs, you know, they might be terribly elaborate designs, but they only use, say, 6 different stitches. And that's because you can use so many different variations. So there's a lot of stitch play in that, and I do find that quite fun.
Okay. Maybe it's just my imagination, just because I'm sitting there stitching and you're in the background and I'm just looking up every now and then. Those came on and I thought, whoa, there's a little something there. Yeah. But it's just, I've never actually held a piece, but it almost has like a blanket look to it.
It can be very, very heavy. Yes. Yeah. So if you think about the fabric that your jeans are made out of, it's that sort of weight of fabric. Uh-huh. And then when you've got the heavy stitching on top, yes, it's heavy.
Yeah. Okay.
If we're talking about chunky, that's a chunky style.
And it's always been stitched that way.
It has. Yes.
Yeah. No, it's beautiful. I mean, there's a delicacy to it in that heaviness, and I just enjoyed watching you show that. And
I think I particularly enjoy doing videos on that because it is so different to the other stuff that I do, and it's different to what a lot of people have seen. So I feel like I'm introducing something quite new to them, and that's always fun.
Yeah, yeah. You mentioned somewhere, it was one of your early ones, about you used a pen or something to mark, and you were hesitant to wash because you weren't sure what it was going to do. What are you using for tools these days to mark patterns and just to get the job done? I'm sure, yep, you've migrated over time.
I have. So what I use now is a washout fabric pencil. So it has, rather than a graphite lead, it has a ceramic lead. And the advantages that I find with using something like that is over what I would call a texter, you would probably call a marker, they bleed into your fabric, whereas a pencil, just you can draw a very fine line on the surface of the fabric and it's not going to bleed because there's nothing to bleed. And it also means that nothing's soaking into the fabric, it's just sitting on the surface. And you can either use an eraser to rub it off, or you can wash it out. And so I find that they're fabulous to use.
Okay, all right. So that's one thing that has always made me nervous. I don't like marking on ground cloth, but you really can't avoid it with this kind of work. Is using pencil with white. I'm always nervous that if you drag the white thread through the pencil, that it'll get on that and smudge it up. So this ceramic pencil does not do that.
It can a little, but because you're going to wash it at the end, that it doesn't matter. But I, when I'm tracing my designs on, I would use a light touch. I don't make heavy, thick black lines because that is just asking for trouble. Mm-hmm. So I would use a line that is as light as I can possibly make it and still be able to see it.
Okay.
Without squinting. Like, I want to be able to see it reasonably right. Well.
Right, right.
Ceramic pencil. What is the brand for that? I'm just making lists here.
So, look, I don't know if you have this brand in America, but the brand that I use is Sewline, Sewline.
Okay. And yes, Gary, we do have that brand in
there
in
you
the
go.
US.
I think okay. Bowen also makes one as well, Bohin. Yeah. And there's probably other ones as well.
Okay. All right. Because, I mean, that's just stuff that bothers me. Is marking, you mark and you draw a thread through it, and then if you wash it, does it spread all over the place, and just all those things. But you still have to make some kind of marking.
And I just watched a video of someone who used a Frixion pencil, and it
they scared me.
It came back. They had rubbed it off, and it was cold. And it came back. The line came back.
You couldn't be pay horrible. Me enough to use one of them. I would never, ever go anywhere near them. They just scare me.
Oh, that would be so sad. After doing all that work. Oh.
That's right. Yeah, you want to know that your work is going to last more than the 2 seconds it takes to put the line on.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Okay. Because that's just... like I have I bought a really hard graphite pencil the first time I tried doing surface embroidery and drew on there, and it worked okay, and I didn't make a really heavy line. But still, I could just feel like that, with colors it really wasn't that much, but with white, you know, that graphite is just going to collect on threads. And I just didn't care for it. But, you know, at some point, you got to make some mark on there to have something to go by.
Yes.
Yeah.
And there are many different ways of making marks on your fabric. Some of them come out, some of them don't come out. You've just got to choose the right one that's right for your circumstances. And that's the one that I have found works best for me.
Yeah. Okay. All right. Adding that to the list. All right. You're getting expensive here. Just talking to you is getting expensive.
I'm sorry. This is why it's taken 4 years to come back to me, isn't it?
That's right. Yeah, I had to save up just so I can afford it. Your early videos, I watched a bunch of them. You were talking about stitching in hand. And then later on, you were showing the what we call the fanny hoop that you had started using that. Is that a migration for you?
No, I've been using one of them for years and years and years. If I'm doing hardanger, then generally, yes, I will do that in hand. I don't do it in a hoop. I actually find when teaching people, it's easier for people, I feel, to get the hang of the mechanics of the stitch if you're doing it in hand rather than in a hoop, because it's not just random poking in and poking out of the needle. It's actually making a sensible movement with your hand, and it helps actually to direct the needle. So that's why I use it in hand for doing hardanger, and I would also use it in hand for doing a lot of the Frisian white work. But for other styles, I would definitely have it in a hoop. Actually, another one that I would not use a hoop for is Sardinian knotted embroidery, and that's because you're working on the surface of the fabric and you need to be able to scoop those threads, and if you have it in a hoop, it will just be nightmarish. It won't work. But that's because it's a very, very different technique.
So it's the flexibility that you need in order to get those stitches the way you want them.
Yeah.
As opposed to taut. Okay.
That's right.
All right. Interesting. Yeah, because I was surprised when you showed it was Hardanger that you were doing and showed in hand. And I was really surprised because I figured you had that latched down on something just as tight as you could get it. just to keep the tension. Yeah.
No. So if I'm demonstrating like at a craft show, I will often have my Hardanger in a hoop there. And that's because it's easier to pick it up and put it down and walk away if I need to serve a customer or something like that. But if I'm doing Hardanger for myself at home, it will always be in hand. But if I'm doing Mount Melek, definitely in a hoop. If I'm doing Smoig, definitely in a hoop. And it's just the different styles of embroidery have different needs, and I've got different needs with them too.
Mm-hmm. Well, interesting. Interesting. And scissors? Now, sadly, Dovo not available anymore. Or I guess you gotta hunt for them and see if anybody's got any left. But have you found another scissor that's as good?
Not yet.
Okay.
Can you hear the sadness in my voice?
Yes.
Oh, yes. I was heartbroken. But I do have a pair of Hardanger scissors from Dovo that I bought myself a while back.
Yeah, mm-hmm. I have them too, and precious. They are precious.
Hide them from the husband who might want to use them for paper.
No, I don't need to do that. He knows.
He wouldn't do it intentionally. He would just be like, oh, scissors, I need to cut this.
No, he would not.
I have to make something special to mark them with.
Yeah, that's another one of those sad things that went away. Because, yeah, I've got three pair of Dovo scissors, a pair of Hardanger too. And, oh, man, they're just so nice. And how they could just not sell enough to stay in business is so frustrating.
Yeah, well, I think that's coronavirus for us, isn't it?
Yeah.
It's been a very difficult period for many people.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Living on the edge to begin with, and then it just puts them over the top. Yeah, it's too bad.
That's right.
Yeah. Mm. I'd hope by now you'd found a better scissor, an equivalent scissor, but not so. Yeah.
Well, I do, like I occasionally bring this up on either my blog or my Facebook page or my YouTube, and people do suggest other ones. Other people love Gingers a lot, but for me, I'm just a Dovo girl.
Yeah. So if you own them, hang on to them. Hang on to them. Yeah.
Yes. Yeah. And don't drop them.
No. Oh. No. No.
But I did that once. I dropped my Dovos and they got a burr on the tips. So I went to the kitchen and I got the sharpening steel for sharpening the knives and I just filed that burr off and they're beautiful again. So there are ways you can fix these things.
Yep. Do you get to a point where you need to have your scissors sharpened, worked on by someone who knows what they're doing?
I haven't got to that point yet, and that's another thing. People ask me all the time, and I've talked with others about it, and the suggestion has been made to me that ask your hairdresser where they get their scissors sharpened, because they need really sharp scissors too. So that's one place that you might be able to ask for a recommendation.
That's interesting. Huh.
Yeah, I hadn't thought about that.
Mm.
Okay. Because I had thought last time I was at the dentist pre-pandemic, I was talking to her, the dental hygienist, about who does the work on her scraping tools, because that's a really fine edge. And so she gave me a contact for that. And actually, she gave me an old pick tool that she didn't use. And I've tried using that just for picking out threads and stuff. And there's some usefulness for that. That was an area, a place I thought about going to get scissors sharpened, real fine blades. But yeah, the hair people, they would know. That's good. Yeah. All right. See, we learned things. It's good. Yep.
That's always good.
That's good. Yeah. All right. Let's talk about this new book. The Friesian.
Yep, Friesian white work, Dutch embroidery from Friesland.
And that's at the printer right now. So when do we get to see that?
Well, you see, I've got this slight problem in that the printer is shut down at the moment for Chinese New Year.
Jeez.
So I really need to get back to my printing rep and say, can I have a timeline for this, please? The way I'm thinking is that it's going to be probably getting to me maybe in about April. And then so in the coming months after that, it should be distributed around the world. So I've been saying mid-year. This morning on my Facebook page, someone said that they had seen it for pre-order somewhere being delivered around July. So I
And that's what
think
I
if
saw.
you, yeah, if you think about you might see it in July, then you won't be disappointed if it comes in May.
So what, tell about this technique. What is different about this technique over some over the others you've done?
Okay, so this comes from the province of Friesland in the Netherlands, and it's probably most similar to Hardanger in that it's a countered white work with lots of eyelets, and there's some cut work and that sort of thing as well. But it has some major differences in that Hardanger is usually done on a block of 4x4 threads, whereas Friesian is done on a block of 3x3 threads or a multiple of that. So it's got some similar stitches, like there's a lot of satin stitch and there's a lot of eyelets, there's pulled thread stitches that are similar between the two, but then Friesian has a whole lot of extra stitches as well. So they have a stitch called topwander stitch. Well, I don't think they call it that, but I've never actually found out what they do call it. So topwander stitch is a name that I have come to from Ukrainian embroidery, actually, because they use it there as well, and that's what the translation of it obviously comes out to be. So that's what I've called it in this book, and it's a beautiful stitch which creates a lot of pattern and texture. And then there's lots of other stitches that you just don't get the huge variety in Hardanger that you do in Friesian. And the interesting thing about it also is that it predates Hardanger by about 100 years. So this is from the 1600s, whereas Hardanger usually was from starting in about the 1700s.
Now are we using linen thread on linen?
We
Is that
are.
still the same?
Yes, we
Okay.
are. That's what they used, so that's what I used too. So I went to the Fries Museum in Leeuwarden and spent some days there with one of the curators just looking at beautiful, beautiful embroideries. What a fun thing my job is.
Now, this technique used to decorate clothes like the others, or have other purposes?
So they would have used it on the collars of men's shirts. They would have also used it on household linen. But a main thing that is still surviving for us are the samplers that they would have worked on. So samplers probably wasn't necessarily the main thing that they would have done it on, but the sheets and things and the shirts haven't necessarily made it down to us through the historical record because they probably wore out. Whereas the samplers would have been treasured, put away in drawers, and so they have lasted a lot more. So the samplers, it's called Friesian white work, but the samplers are often done in colour. And that's because they may have been done by young girls who were creating a repository of stitches and motifs and that sort of thing from which to draw on for their later life when they would have had to embroider their husband's shirts. And the girls wouldn't necessarily have enjoyed stitching in white on white as much as I do, so they used colour a lot of the time. So it's called Friesian white work, but you'll often see samplers done either in all colour or partially in colour.
And go ahead.
I was just going to say, for those who are curious, your YouTube, I want to say it's number 68, it shows that the sampler from the book. And I'm like,
Yes.
okay, now I've got to go pre-order that book because I have to do that sampler. It is just gorgeous.
I had so much fun making that sampler, and it is definitely my favorite project from the book.
And I'm not a smalls kind of person. I mean, I love how they look, but give me a big project anytime. So.
Yeah. Well, the thing is also, so the stitches that are on that sampler would have been then So you think of a sampler as being something beautiful that we frame and stick on the wall, but that wasn't its purpose. It was for sampling things, for trying things out, and for making a record that they could then draw from later on. So all of the things that are on that sampler could then be taken and used, say, on the collar of a shirt if you wish to make yourself a shirt. So, you don't have to use it as a sampler. You can use it as a place to draw from.
Right.
Yeah, it is beautiful sampler. It really is. It's
thank you.
That whole mental step where we look at samplers as art, and whether it's a schoolgirl cross stitch sampler or any number of these things, they're just functional devices for them. And I really struggle to see them as functional devices. Because we have books and illustrations that show you how to do that stuff. So why have the example? But they had to do that in some way. And plus it was a demonstration of skills, but it's just such a mental leap for me to look at that as a functional device. And because like that one that's in that book, I mean, it's just beautiful. And how is that functional? You know, hang it on the wall and let people gape at it.
So. Functional can be beautiful as well.
Yeah. Yeah. Now, is this book, like the others, in that we have a few projects and then plenty of carefully illustrated technique diagrams?
Yes, it is. So the first section of the book, there's a little bit there on the history and the culture that surrounds the embroidery, and then there's a whole section of beautiful, beautiful historical pieces that you can just drool over. So I'm thinking that a lot of people will have very ruffled pages in that section for all the drool that's gone on and they've dried. And then the next section of the book, there's 10 different projects from the very large, like the beautiful sampler, to small things like there's a selection of strawberries. There's a pin cushion and a needle case. There are some cushions as well. So there's a wide range of projects in terms of their size and also their difficulty, so that you can start with something small and work up to something bigger, or start with something bigger if you want to. And then the last section of the book, there are step-by-step instructions for all of the stitches and techniques, and they are both in left-handed and right-handed, because I am left-handed, and so why not give the left-handers the instructions they need as well?
And thank you for that.
My pleasure.
As a left-hander, thank you for that. Yes. Yeah.
And that's how I first found you, is I was teaching guild at my guild, and I knew I had a left-handed student, and mm-hmm. your book was in our library system. So I ordered it in and brought it, and immediately all the left-handers ordered it in. They bought
right.
They're like, well, okay, I need this book.
I wrote it because whenever I was teaching embroidery, my left-handed students would love having a left-handed teacher. And I thought, well, I can't be everywhere. So if I put myself into a book, then I can be everywhere. So I really do hope that a lot of teachers do take it for their students, just to help them out. Because there are some right-handed teachers who have no trouble teaching left-handers, but there are an awful lot who do. I have heard so many sorry tales from left-handers of going into a class and the teacher looking at them and saying, oh, you're left-handed, I can't teach you. And I just think that's just not fair.
Yeah.
Well, if I said that to my right-handed students, I would not be invited back.
Right, exactly. Well, see, that's right. What, you know, any of us who are left-handed, I mean, that's one of my childhood traumas, was learning to write. And mm-hmm. and I hook my hand and write. And, of course, I numerous times getting scolded and smacked on the hand, you know, the pencil has to point over your shoulder. And, you know, Mrs. Smith or whoever you are, I cannot see what I'm writing when I have my hand like that. And it drags across the pencil and smears everything. So mm-hmm. I have to do something so I can see what I'm writing. And I remember conversations with my mother about how, you know, he just won't do it right. I can't help it. I got to see what I'm doing. And as a result, my penmanship is horrible. Because it just really soured me on the whole thing. And so I taught myself, once I was out of that, I just taught myself to do what worked for me and moved on. And so when you know, when you do something like that, where you put together a book that helps left-handers, you know, I'm sure every left-hander in the world has some kind of a trauma where they've, you know, growing up, they've had to learn in a right-handed world. Yeah.
I have heard that left-handed people statistically die earlier than right-handed people.
And oh, is that
I think
right?
That's because of the trauma that we've been through.
That's yes. We're tortured
I don't
people.
Know if that's true.
We're tortured.
That's terrible, terrible. Oh. But yeah, that's it was an excellent book. And so I was always glad, you know, that, you know, I have it available for, you know, I just teach locally. I don't consider myself a teacher so much, but it's
that's
nice
okay.
to have
that's,
that.
That's good too.
Well, you know, and it's, you know, we need local people teaching, but
exactly.
So I know that's one of the reasons the early style Hardanger book came across through our guild too, because the left-handers mm-hmm. bought it because they knew it's yeah. going to have left-handed instructions.
Yeah. Well, once I started doing left-handed instructions, there was no way I was ever going to stop.
Well, it's an important contribution for those of us who are in the minority, yes.
Well, I hope so.
Yep.
And the other thing, I've got to go back to the Frisian white work. Those, the initials, mm-hmm. and you made like a bolster pillow with them. And they are so intriguing. And you see those same sort of style in, there's a, in the Frisian, just the samplers.
The cross-stitch ones, yes.
Right. So did those come later, those cross-stitch samplers? I hate to pull that.
I don't know. I've never looked into that. I would say that they would have probably been contemporaries of each other, just different ways of doing similar things. So what Beth is talking about is that one of the main features of Frisian white work are these very large, elaborate initials. So I've used them on a cushion with my initials YS, and they would have used them as a way of marking laundry. So if we go back to the very early times, you know, laundry was sent off to be laundered elsewhere and you had to mark it so that it came back to you. So those initials would have probably started off being terribly pedestrian, just useful, a simple Y and a simple S. But over time, they got more and more elaborate until they became what they are for Frisian white work, which is over the top and exquisitely beautiful. But the same sort of thing also developed within the cross-stitch tradition. So the Frisian cross-stitch samplers would have similar sorts of elaborate large initials.
I wonder over time if that's just kind of an ongoing silent competition in a community of
probably
yeah.
I'm going to outdo Mrs. Smith down the road because right. my initials are going to be much better than hers.
Yep.
So did you find samples of those sheets? Because I mean, that's such a utilitarian item. Did they last?
Yes. So I did see some of them, and they had obviously not been used very much because they were just amazing. So they would have often been made from fabric that wasn't wide enough to cover the bed, so they would have had a large insertion section down the middle with drawn thread work and drawn thread work. So very lacy down the middle, so I'm not quite sure how that would have kept them warm. and then on either side of that, they might have had one initial on one side and one on the other, or they might have had two initials together with, say, a heart or a crown in between. And all these sorts of motifs would have had obvious symbolism, and there would have been trees of life and that sort of thing as well.
It's interesting that, you know, these days there's so much activity in terms of using embroidery to decorate clothes. And mm-hmm. Beth is even doing some of that here just recently. And that how that approach, that use of needlework, ebbs and flows through history, but never really goes away. And here all these ancient techniques are exactly for that. But even today, just using needlework to decorate and embellish clothing. And yeah, because as we do all these little projects that are going to go in frames and whatnot, I mean, that's that practical use is still there. Yeah.
Wearing embroidered clothing is a really, really wonderful thing to be able to do because, you know, it's a way of enjoying embroidery in our everyday lives. And also, if it's something that you enjoy, then why not wear it and show it off to other people? You don't have to hide it away on your walls at home or on your lounges or on your bed or anything like that. You can actually wear it and let other people enjoy it as well.
Do you find yourself buying blouses with the intent of doing work on them?
No, because no? If I was going to make an embroidered blouse, then I would make the blouse.
Oh, okay.
Okay. I was wondering that myself because I'm not a seamstress. So I thought, where did she get her blouse that she's making that collar on? So
no,
I can buy something.
I made it.
Oh.
So it's quite difficult to insert a collar on a, I mean, of course you could insert your own collar on a shirt, but I would prefer to do the whole thing myself because I can.
Right. I've had to insert a collar, so I prefer not to do that again.
Yeah, I can understand that.
That was painful.
Hmm.
But over the years, have you developed a collection of clothes that show off your needlework?
So I've got about 3 embroidered shirts. There's a hardanger one. There are 2 smoig collar ones. And I don't make any what am I trying to say? I don't say that these are traditional pieces of clothing. They are modern pieces of clothing that I have chosen to use those styles of embroidery on. So I'm not trying to emulate what they did for their traditional clothing. I'm just putting it on a modern shirt for myself.
Mm-hmm.
I also have an awful lot of embroidered pendants that I love wearing because they're quick, they're easy, and they're just enjoyable to wear, and other people like looking at them.
Mm-hmm.
Well, and I remember watching you, you were showing them, I think, right before Christmas. Mm-hmm. And I thought, what a lovely idea, even because people are putting jewelry on their floss rings,
yes,
which is nice. And I thought, those would be the perfect size, you know, a quick thing you could stitch up for a friend or for like a stitchy exchange, mm-hmm. and it'd be your own little stitch piece.
Yep, they make great gifts.
They just look perfect.
Well, I think so.
Do you do much stitching outside of the white work you need for your projects and designing?
No.
for your books, is that pretty
no
much...
I don't generally have time.
Okay. All right.
Though recently I have been stitching quite a few pendants because they're just the sort of thing that I can stitch one in an evening while I'm watching some TV or just while I'm waiting in the car for my daughter at gymnastics. I can just stitch something, and they're easy to carry around. They're small and just very achievable. So I have been doing a lot of them lately.
Okay. So there's your classic right there. Take your needlework when you have to drag the kids to wherever and wait for them. Yep.
Right.
Yep.
So waiting in the car.
Yes, and I do a lot of that.
Yeah.
Yep. Sitting in the bleachers, yep. Yep. There we have it. All right, so we have the Friesian white work coming up here in the next couple months, so people can pre-order that. And all of Yvette's other books, yeah, get them. They're very well done. That's the thing that I enjoy, though I've yet to do a project out of the Hardanger book. The illustrations for the various stitches are so well done. It's really exceptional. You can show it. It really shows the effort, and for me, it makes it even that much more approachable in terms of the technique because you just do an excellent job of illustrating those things.
Well, that's lovely to hear. Thank you.
Yeah, they're very well done. Yep. All right, Yvette. Thanks. That was fun.
Thank you. I enjoyed
it
too.
Thank you so much, Yvette.
Yep.
Thanks for having me.
All right. Thanks to everybody for listening.